We're going to talk about the kinds of risk communication, learning, using what we have learned about hazard and outrage. So we're going to graph hazard against outrage. And I'm going to point you to the interesting corners of the graph. We're going to start down in the lower right-hand corner, down here, high hazard, low outrage. People are endangered, but not likely to be upset. We're talking about driving, we're talking about smoking, we're talking about not exercising, we're talking about overeating, you know, all the high hazard, low outrage risks. This is the venue of what I call precaution advocacy. And in ways that I hope are obvious to you, given what we have talked about so far this morning, the very essence of precaution advocacy is to try to increase the outrage. You're not trying to increase the outrage for the fun of it. You're trying to increase the outrage because you understand the causal structure of the situation you're working on. You're trying to increase the outrage in order to increase the hazard perception, in order to increase people's willingness to take precautions or demand precautions or tolerate precautions. So this is what you do if you're an activist group. You are trying to get people more outraged so that they will demand that EPA take more precautions. It's also what you do if you're a company health, safety, and environment person. You're trying to get employees more outraged. You know, and now more outrage is probably going to mean more fearful rather than more angry, in order to increase their willingness to wear their PPE. Okay, so I mean, by and large, corporate health and safety people don't see themselves as in the same business as activists, but from a risk communication perspective, they are in the same business. They are both in the precaution advocacy business. They are trying to get people more upset in order to get them to take precautions. Okay. With hazard perception as the intervening variable. More upset, therefore higher perception, higher hazard perception, therefore more willing to take precautions. Okay. Now, this isn't the only way to get people to take precautions. You can pay people to take precautions. You can punish people if they don't take precautions. You can give them role models and point out that their favorite rock star takes this precaution, so if they want to be a rock star too, they should take this precaution. There is a list of, you know, 10 or 15 things you can do to increase the likelihood that people will take precautions other than increase their outrage about the risk. One of the other ones that I didn't mention is sometimes the task is to decrease their outrage about the precaution. You know, that I don't want to wear my safety goggles because they're geeky looking and they itch. And if that's why I'm not wearing my safety goggles, then precaution advocacy to get me to wear my safety goggles isn't mostly increasing how worried I am that something's gonna blind me. It's decreasing how much I hate the goggles. Okay, are you with me? So there are more things to be done in precaution advocacy than increasing outrage about the risk. But the plain vanilla basic, this is what you do unless you have a damn good reason to do something more complicated. The most straightforward thing you do in precaution advocacy is this arrow. You increase outrage in order to increase hazard perception, in order to increase precaution taking. Everything else is, if you can't do this for some reason, here's a list of secondary things you might try. Okay? But this is the plain vanilla one. We're not going to talk much about precaution advocacy today. So if you're interested, then you can go to the precaution advocacy part of my website and learn lots of stuff about precaution advocacy. All I want to say today about precaution advocacy as kind of a straw man for talking more about outrage management is to give you three tech specs, three obvious tech specs for doing good precaution advocacy. The first tech spec is keep your message short. Why do messages have to be short in precaution advocacy? Anybody? What? Because they're not interested, exactly. A synonym for low outrage is apathy, Apathetic people have a short attention span. If you try to drone on and on and on and on, they lose interest. So precaution advocacy has to be brief. The second tech spec is make it interesting. That's grounded in exactly the same reality. If, you know, because they are not interested, if you can make it interesting, maybe you can get more attention. Maybe instead of, you know, I mean, if you give them half a minute of interesting irrelevancy, you tell a joke, you tell a riddle, you sing a song. Those of you who have been to safety meetings have seen all of this happen. I mean, there's nothing quite as boring as a corporate safety meeting. And the people who run corporate safety meetings are desperate to keep the folks awake. And they do things to make the meeting interesting. And, you know, I mean, if 30 seconds of irrelevance will keep people awake for 2 minutes, you have just gained 90 seconds to talk about safety. You know, and that's a bargain. So making it interesting is essential to precaution advocacy. The third tech spec is stay on message. Okay, you figure out what the most useful things to say are to get this particular audience taking this particular precaution. You test it, you wordsmith it, you test it some more, and once you've decided you've got the very best use of your limited window of opportunity, you stick to your messages come hell or high water. Precaution advocacy is mostly a monologue. Okay, if the other side wants to talk to you, for God's sake, shut up and listen to them. But usually they don't. You're talking to apathetic people. PR people are intuitively good at precaution advocacy because the underlying model is the same. The underlying model of PR is you're talking to people about things that are a lot more interesting to you than to them. And that is also the underlying model of precaution advocacy, that you're talking to apathetic people, trying to get them to take a precaution that they're not terribly interested in taking. In the opposite corner, where hazard is low and outrage is high, this is the venue of what I call outrage management. They're really both outrage management, but this is managing the outrage up. And this is managing the outrage down. But in outrage management, in ways, again, I hope will be obvious by now, the core task is to reduce the outrage. And again, you're not reducing the outrage for the fun of it. You're reducing the outrage because you understand the causal system you're working in. You're reducing the outrage in order to reduce the hazard perception, in order to reduce people's inclination to take or demand precautions that you think are foolish. Now, it's obvious, but it's worth saying, that different people can be engaged in different tasks with respect to the same issue with the same audience. So that typically, or at least certainly quite often, in a controversy, the company is doing outrage management because it thinks people are excessively outraged, and the activist is doing precaution advocacy because it thinks people are insufficiently outraged, and you are either on one side or the other, or maybe you're trying to stay in the middle, which is an awkward place to stay, as you all know, and sort of referee the fight. Yeah, there's nothing in this model that tells us which side is right. And the people doing precaution advocacy may be doing it because they believe it, or they may be doing it because that's their job. The people doing outrage management also may be doing it because they believe it or because that's their job. And if you know anything about cognitive dissonance, you know that if you're doing it because it's your job, very quickly you come to believe it. So it's reliable that almost everybody, I mean, you know, it's very rare for people to be self-awarely dishonest. Almost everybody in these battles is convinced that they're right. And as you also know, very often the data are hard to find and easy to interpret in any of several directions, so that they usually have a case to make that they're right. Which puts you guys, when you're regulating, in a very tough place because, you know, you're talking to a company that has good data to show that this is bullshit, and you're talking to an activist group or an outraged neighborhood that has good data to show that this is cataclysmic. Neither set of data is terrific. Both sets of data are, you know, good data is kind of an exaggeration, but there you are. There, you know, both sides believe they're right. Both sides have some technical support for the belief that they're right, and you're supposed to adjudicate. So you're in a indeed in a very awkward position. Once you decide which side you're on, you're in a much easier position. You know, whether you make that decision based on data or political pressure or ideology, and I'm not going to get into how you make that decision. But once you make a decision and you know what side you're on, then life becomes much easier. But what's important here is let's, you know, if the paradigm in precaution advocacy is watch out, okay? Right, in precaution advocacy, the key thing you're doing is trying to warn people. The paradigm is watch out, this could kill you. You know, wear a seatbelt, wear a hard hat, wear a condom. Not necessarily all at the same time. If that's the paradigm in precaution advocacy, the paradigm in outrage management is calm down. Now, the message isn't calm down. Why not? Yeah, calm down is not a calming message. You know, I mean, especially if your message is, you know, calm down, you hysterical fool. You know, that's not a message that's well calculated to calm people, so you rarely have occasion to actually say calm down, but that's still the paradigm. That is to say, your goal is to reduce the outrage. That's what calm down means. Your goal is to reduce the outrage in order to reduce the hazard perception, in order to reduce their inclination to take or demand unnecessary precautions. And just as there are other ways besides making people upset to get them to do, you know, to get them to take precautions, there are other ways besides making people less upset to get them to stop taking or stop demanding precautions. But once again, the vanilla way, the basic way, the one you use unless you have a very good reason to look for harder ones, is this arrow. So the essence of outrage management is to try to reduce people's outrage. Now, let's look at the three tech specs for precaution advocacy and see how well they apply to the challenge of outrage management. The first of the three was keep your message short. Do you have to keep your message short in outrage management? They come to a meeting and stay till midnight, you know. Instead of maybe 20 seconds, you have maybe 6 or 7 hours, you know. And then next week they come again and you have another 6 or 7 hours. You wish you had to keep your message short, okay? You long for the wonderful days of apathetic audiences, okay? But, you know, keeping your message short is not super important when you're talking to people who are passionate about the issue, who are highly outraged, and they're staying until the meeting is over, and after it's over, they're bothering you in the parking lot and wondering why you didn't go on all night. So brevity is no longer a criterion. The second tech spec for precaution advocacy was make it interesting. Do you have to make it interesting in outrage management? They're already interested. Okay. They are, in fact, obsessed, okay. And your goal, or a part of your goal, is to make it boring. Okay. Now, that doesn't mean you can afford to give a boring speech. What happens if you bring 200 PowerPoint slides to a meeting full of outraged people and you start droning on about the data? Do they get bored? What do they get? Outraged. How dare you waste my time with this crap? So you can't afford to give a boring speech, but it is your goal in outrage management to bore them, just as it is your goal in precaution advocacy to rouse them. It is your goal in outrage management to push them in the opposite direction, to bore them. So your ultimate goal is at some point in the future, they're going to say to each other, well, there's another meeting, you know, about the contamination tonight. Shall we go to the meeting or shall we stay home and watch reruns on television? let's stay home and watch reruns on television. It sounds more interesting. Okay? And if you can get people to the point where television reruns sound more interesting than your meeting, you have accomplished an important piece of outrage management. Okay? Does that make sense to everybody? Now, that's in stark contrast to the values of public participation. And you know, some of you have studied, you know, IAP2 and other organizations that are interested in bringing, you know, people together to share their views and to dialogue with each other and figure out what to do. And there are complicated relationships between public engagement and outrage management. It's certainly crucial in outrage management to engage the people who want to engage you. But it isn't your goal to engage them in outrage management. It's your goal to get them to decide they don't want to engage you anymore. Okay? If they decide that for the right reason. If they decide they don't want to engage you because you're not listening and you're a jerk and they'd much rather sue you or bomb you or take some other step, then that's not your goal. But if they decide they don't want to engage you because they're satisfied with what you're doing, they know others are engaging you and you're engaging them in a suitably responsive way, it looks like you know, your plans and your regulatory scheme is viable and is honorable and is effective. And now that environmental protection is working well, they're not interested in being sort of junior, unpaid environmental protection people. They would rather stay home and watch television. That's great. That's your goal. You don't want people who think they have to do your job for you. You want people who think they don't have to do your job for you and can safely stay home. Okay. Am I making sense? Okay, so indeed, you know, where, you know, the second tech spec for precaution advocacy was to make it interesting. The tech spec for outrage management is to make it boring, but not by giving a boring speech, rather by getting them to the point where they think the issue is sufficiently under control that they can gratefully go back to their lives instead. The third tech spec for precaution advocacy was stay on message. I argued right before the break that what you want to do is figure out the most useful way to use your limited time. And having figured that out and tested it and wordsmithed it, then stick to your messages come hell or high water. Is that what you do in outrage management? No. Why do outraged people come to a public meeting? What are their tech specs? What are they there for?
To be listened to.
To be listened to, absolutely. We have a word we very often use. They want to vent. Okay? And they have their own tech specs. They don't want to vent in a closet. They want to vent in front of you, in front of each other, and in front of journalists. And nothing useful can happen until they have an opportunity to vent. I have a lot of clients that will ask me, how can I keep these outraged people from venting? And it's not like that's a hard question to answer. There's lots of things you can do to make venting more difficult. Don't have a meeting. If you're going to have a meeting, have it, you know, using a science fair design instead of an actual meeting design. And you all know how you do that, right? I mean, anyone interested in this issue, go over here. If you're interested in that issue, go over there. If you're interested in that third issue, go across town to that room. And you set it up so that everybody isn't in the same room at the same time. Nobody has an opportunity to vent in front of everybody. The journalists don't have a good story to write because it's spread out all over town. And that's justified on the grounds that everyone will have a one-on-one opportunity to ask questions. But, you know, it's not a secret that your real reason for wanting to do that is it's very hard to vent. So it's not hard to keep people from venting. It's just dumb to keep people from venting. I mean, if people are outraged and they want to vent, nothing useful can happen until they have had an opportunity to vent. In that sense, an angry meeting is like a pressure relief valve on a tank of gas. If you've got a tank of gas under pressure, You put in a pressure relief valve, so if the pressure gets too high, the valve will bleed off some pressure and you won't explode the tank. You are all familiar with that technology. An angry meeting is a PRV. Okay, and it would be really stupid to take the pressure relief valve out of your tank, because then your tank is likely to explode. It is similarly stupid not to have an angry public meeting when people are very angry. You want them to vent their anger. Okay? So they come to vent, and you come to listen to them vent. And it's got to be active listening. You're not allowed to read your emails. You have to listen. You have to take notes. You have to nod your head. You have to murmur, uh-huh. All the things you learned if you ever took a course in active listening. It's about a 15-minute course. It's not very hard to learn active listening, but it's a useful 15 minutes. And if they are venting and you are listening, what happens? They calm down. Now, not all the way calm, because, you know, whatever was making them outraged is still generating outrage. You haven't done anything to stop the generation of outrage, but the pent-up accumulated outrage is getting vented. So there's less outrage in the system. It's a hydraulic system. There's less outrage in the system, and as some of the outrage gets vented, yes, more is being manufactured, but there is at least a temporary decline in how much outrage they're experiencing. Okay. So as you listen, they calm down, and as they calm down, a very important thing starts to happen. They start wanting to hear from you. They didn't start out wanting to hear from you. They started out wanting to shut you up so they could vent. But if you listen long enough, I absolutely guarantee the moment will come when they want to hear from you. So I advise my clients in high outrage environments, you know, say as little as possible early on. You know, yeah, tell them where the bathrooms are. But say as little as possible early on. Don't ever take the first couple of hours of an angry meeting talking to people. You know what happens if you take the first couple of hours of an angry meeting talking? What are they doing while you're talking? You know, they're getting angrier and angrier and angrier, and they're rehearsing their vent. You can actually watch their mouths move. They are rehearsing their vent. They're not hearing a word you say until they have had an opportunity to vent. You know, depending on their psychology, they may be imagining that after they vent, they're going to be the hero of the evening and will be carried out on the shoulders of the crowd. They may be imagining that you will humiliate them with your response and they will slink away, never to be seen again. Whatever they're imagining, there's a psychodrama in their head that's about what they want to say and has nothing to do with what you're trying to tell them. So nothing gets communicated until they've had a chance to vent. So instead of you dominating the meeting early on, you listen, they vent, and little by little, they start wondering what you think of all the things they've told you. And finally, and it may take hours, it may even take a couple of meetings, finally, somebody gets in your face and says, well, what have you got to say? You've been sitting there like a bump on a log. I can tell you're listening. You know, you're taking notes. I can tell you're hearing me, but you haven't said a word. What do you think? What's your answer to all we've been telling you? Okay. I promise you that'll happen. The first time it happens, demur. Gee, I think it's premature. There are people who haven't spoken yet. I'm learning so much this evening. You try not to let that sound sarcastic. Okay. And eventually the entire room unites behind the premise that it's your turn. Okay. They start shushing each other up to listen to you. Come on now, she listened to us, now we have to listen to her. And a silence settles on the room and everybody turns to you. Now do you pull out your PowerPoint slides? No. What do you do when you finally have the attention of the crowd? You've waited all night, maybe all month, and finally they actually are demanding that you speak. What are you going to say? Tell them you've heard them. Acknowledge the issues they've raised. Those are both excellent, but they have to be done carefully. You know, if you say, I know how you feel, that's good for another hour of venting. right? You know, Bill Clinton could get away with saying, I feel your pain, but I've never known anyone else who could. So you want to acknowledge what they're saying and what they're feeling very tentatively. And I usually advise clients to make it a question. Let me see if I understand what you've been telling me. I've been listening very hard. And if I'm hearing you right, it seems to me there are three themes I keep hearing all night. A lot of people in the room really want us to do X. A lot of people are very angry that we did Y. And a lot of people are worried that Z might happen. Okay. So you are summarizing their issues, but you're summarizing it in a question. You're not telling them you heard what they said. You're asking them if you heard what they said. Okay. Still, the structure of this meeting is exactly as you've described it. Early on in the meeting, they get to tell you what a jerk they think you are. Later on in the meeting, you get to tell them what a jerk they think you are. Okay? At neither point in the meeting do you get to tell them what a jerk you think they are. Okay? Because that would not manage their outrage. Now, this is profoundly counterintuitive. The intuitive thing to do when people are venting at you and you finally get the floor is to vent back. Okay? Or to put more meat on those bones. When people are venting at you, what they say invariably has three components. Some of what they say is valid grievances. Some of what they say is exaggerated complaints with a germ of truth. And some of what they say is crap. Now, if you are a normal human being and people have been venting at you for hours with this mix of valid grievances, exaggerated complaints, and crap, and you finally get the floor, which of the three will you probably respond to? The crap. Okay? You ignore the valid grievances. You ignore the exaggerated complaints with a germ of truth, and you rebut the crap. And there's always crap to rebut, so it's not like you're making it up. It's not like you're lying. You're taking the stupidest things they said all night and proving them stupid. Okay. Whose outrage are you managing? Your own. Okay? If you want to manage your outrage and their outrage instead of your outrage, you ignore the crap. And you focus on validating the valid grievances. If there aren't any valid grievances about hazard, there will always be valid grievances about outrage. If you can't validate that dimethyl meatloaf is deadly and you guys, you know, screwed up your risk assessment, you can validate that we've been unresponsive and we haven't been answering your emails. You can always find things to validate in their complaints about you. And you focus on validating the valid grievances. Now, for heaven's sake, don't validate the crap. Nobody should get the impression that you brought this American expert and he said, whatever people say, tell them they're right. If it's crap, it's crap. And, you know, validating crap is not good outrage management. It's not sustainable. Okay? Rebutting crap is also not good outrage management. Park the crap and validate the valid grievances. Now, even early on, you need a venue where you rebut the crap. If you don't rebut the crap early enough, you know, you're going to give the impression that, you know, but, you know, you've essentially validated the crap by not rebutting it. So every organization should have a crap rebuttal corner of its website. Okay. It's not usually called crap rebuttal. It's usually called frequently asked questions. Okay. Sometimes it's called something like myth and reality, which is an awful lot like crap rebuttal as a label. But whatever you call it, you need a place on your website where you can say, a lot of people believe X, but X isn't true. The truth is Y. You need that. Even very early, you need that. But it's a huge mistake to use precious face time with hostile stakeholders rebutting crap. You know, rebut crap much later in your interaction, and early on, rebut crap in some corner of your website, but use your face time to validate their valid grievances. So what am I saying? In dealing with outraged people, First step is you listen. Second step is you echo. Third step is you validate. Okay, listen, then echo, then validate. You know, way down the road, you argue. You're going to have to argue. You disagree on some stuff, and it, you know, you're going to have to argue. But if you're doing outrage management with outraged people, arguing early is silly. You know, you listen, you echo, you validate. Okay. Now, does everybody see that this is fairly different from what you do in precaution advocacy? Okay. You can be good at both. I mean, you know, you can be a good carpenter and a good electrician, but you need two toolkits. And you need some diagnostic skill in knowing when you've got a carpentry problem and when you've got an electrical problem. If you walk around with a hammer, you know, hammering nails into circuits, you're going to make things worse. Okay? And similarly, if you use precaution advocacy skills, which are also PR skills, in a high outrage environment, you will make things worse. Now, if you use outrage management skills in a low outrage environment, you will also make things worse, but that's a rare mistake. The common mistake is to do precaution advocacy / PR when you should be doing outrage management. The rare mistake is to do outrage management when you should be doing precaution advocacy and PR. But for sure, they are different skills depending on where you are on the map. Am I talking to people whose outrage exceeds the hazard? Or am I talking to people whose outrage is less than the hazard? And everything depends on where you are on the map. Okay. In the third corner, upper right-hand corner, high hazard, high outrage. This is the venue of crisis communication. Now be careful, outrage management is often called crisis communication because it's a crisis for your organization. Your crisis is that they mistakenly think there's a crisis. Okay. But real crisis communication is when they rightly think there's a crisis, when people are upset and they're right to be upset because they're genuinely endangered. The outrage is high, the hazard is also high. An infectious disease outbreak. An explosion, a natural disaster. It doesn't have to be health and safety. A plant closing. You know, I mean, if one of your major industries decides it's leaving New South Wales permanently, for the employees of that industry, it's a crisis. You know, they've got an employment crisis. What are they going to have to find another job or pull their kid out of high school or do whatever they're going to do? It's not a health and safety crisis. It's a life crisis. Okay, are you with me? Okay, in crisis communication, hazard is high and outrage is also high. There is therefore no arrow to draw. The goal in risk communication is always to make the outrage commensurate with the hazard. So if in outrage management the outrage is too high, in precaution advocacy the outrage is too low, and again, remember, this is a matter of opinion. it's your judgment that counts. In crisis communication, the outrage is on target. Okay, so there is no need to make people more upset. They're upset enough. And you have no right to try to make people less upset. The key sin in outrage management is to act as if it were precaution advocacy and talk in sound bites. The key sin in crisis communication is act as if it was outrage management and try to calm people. Okay? You got no business calming people who are rightly upset. Remember, outrage motivates precautions. It is the predominant thing that motivates precautions. If you're in this corner, precautions are going to be needed. The outrage is therefore useful. It is not in your interest, and it is not honorable, and it doesn't normally work to try to calm down people who are rightly upset in a crisis. So if the paradigm in precaution advocacy is watch out, and the paradigm in outrage management is calm down, the paradigm in crisis communication is we'll get through this together. Okay. You know, if you want help with crisis communication, study the World War II speeches of Winston Churchill. He never, ever told people, it's just Nazis, nothing to worry about. He was not trying to reduce their outrage. He was trying to guide their outrage. Because people in a crisis who have the right level of outrage aren't necessarily going to do the right thing. That outrage is going to motivate precautions, but it may motivate the wrong precautions. So what you're trying to do in a crisis is validate their outrage and guide their outrage. You want to tell them, the sin in crisis communication is to tell them they're wrong to be upset. The goal in crisis communication is to tell them they're right to be upset and then help them bear it and help them act wisely rather than unwisely. Okay. It's a third paradigm. These three have very little to do with each other. They're really three entirely different toolkits. We're going to be focusing today on the outrage management toolkit. You want to bring me back another time, we can talk about the crisis communication toolkit and the precaution advocacy toolkit. Obviously, environment protection organizations have need for all three at different times. Okay. Or with different audiences. Sometimes it depends on the issue. Sometimes it depends on the audience. You might very well be doing precaution advocacy for people who have high levels of dimethyl meatloaf in their groundwater, and outrage management for people who have low levels. So it may depend on the audience, or it may depend on the situation, or it may depend on who you work for and what your values are. But you can't do anything sensible until you have figured out where you are on the map. Okay? How high is the hazard? How high is the outrage? In your opinion, how high is the hazard likely to get? How high is the outrage likely to get? And based on your answers to those four questions, what kind of risk communication do I need to do? This is the map. This is the core, in my judgment, the core of risk communication right here. Anytime you face a risk communication task, ask yourself where you are on the map with regard to a particular audience at a particular time. And then, in a few weeks, ask yourself again, because the situation may change, and you may be in a different place on the map than you were a few weeks ago.